Welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, a weekly podcast from Hobeck Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, mystery, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of running a creative business in this challenging world. We'll hear from the people who make this possible, the authors, the cover designers and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on the Hobcast Book Show from Hobeck Books, as we combine trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello. Hello, and welcome to the Hobcast, episode number 114.
You remember every week.
I do. I had to look it up, to be fair. My name is Adrian Hobart.
My name's Rebecca Collins.
And together we run Hobeck Books, UK independent publishers of the following four genres.
Suspense.
Mysteries.
Crime.
And the other one.
Thrillers.
Thrillers. That's it. You got it. Thank you for helping me out there. Welcome to the show. And this week we are speaking to different guests to the one we advertised last week. There's a good reason for that.
Yeah, so the guest we told you we were going to have had an illness in the family, so couldn't make it. And that's actually very timely. So we had two guests.
Yes.
Who published their book just 2 weeks ago.
They did, and they are Bryn Thompson and Steve Lowndes. And we've been working with them on their book, Transformational Selling. It's a business book. It's brilliant. And you edited it.
Yeah.
I've done the narration for it. And they had double book launches, one in Mayfair in London and the other in Cheshire just this week. And we thought we'd invite them on, talk about the process, how it's long it's taken them to get from idea in a Dallas bar to publication. And I think there's a lot to be got from it, from that point of view, but most of it actually is about the business. I mean, they work in business to business selling, which is different to what we do, which is business to customer to a degree. Yeah, I mean, you know, we are working in a sort of business to business situation when we work with them, but there is so much to be got from this interview, so we look forward to speaking to Bryn and Steve a little bit later. Let's get into some news, shall we?
Yes. So the first piece of news I found is about somebody who we've had on the podcast, the lovely Kate Moss, who's a very well-known writer. And she is also responsible for the Woman's Prize for Fiction. And I think that's sort of, you know, her pride and joy. And last month it was in the news that she is starting the Woman's Prize for Nonfiction as well to go with it, which I think is brilliant. Because I'm a non-fiction writer. If I'm going to write a book, it's probably going to be non-fiction. So I think it's good to give more opportunities for people who write non-fiction to enter these things. And she's going to be appearing at the London Book Fair, which is it May?
I think it's June this year.
It certainly was last year,
yeah. And it moved from April to June, partly to give themselves a little bit more breathing space with COVID, I think.
Oh, right. Okay. So she's going to be appearing to talk about that, which is great.
I'll tell you what, I'll check up the exact details and I'll bring those to you in a moment.
Okay. So I could talk a little bit more about this prize because it's...
Please.
So the trust who Kate works with on the prize, they say that the Women's Prize for Nonfiction will further amplify female voices while celebrating books that inform, challenge, disrupt, I love that word, and offer solace and connection. So that's the Charlotte Aitken Trust.
Excellent.
They give a prize of £30,000 for the winners. That's the prize money, which is fantastic, isn't it? Can you imagine winning that? It'd be happy days.
Well, look, I tell you what, we got it completely wrong. London Book Fair is the 18th to 20th of April. It's round the corner.
It's
less than a month away.
Yeah, just under, yeah.
Wow. Now, we're taking a decision, executive decision, not to go this year, I think.
Yeah, I mean, we sort of dithered with whether to go just for the day, but we haven't actually put that idea beyond a chat.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we found it very tough last year. It's not an event where a small publisher, unless you've got some sort of spot, which costs a lot of money just to even have a chair and a half a sort of metre of bookshelf in the IPG stand. I mean, we're talking, you know, good big four figures of just for that privilege, somewhere to stick your bag.
Yes, which we did feel the lack of, didn't we?
We did. I mean, look, we might go for a day because, you know, it is a good place to make some contacts for the podcast point of view. From the business point of view, there is no point Hoback being there. We are now represented on audio and we are busily negotiating a representation elsewhere for other aspects of our business because, you know, it's very clear you get the experts in because we can't do everything. But, you know, we couldn't get in to see the agents because that's a particular part of the fair that's fenced off and surrounded by security. And in the end, I just found it totally overwhelming, actually. And I'm beginning to get a real problem with being in crowds now. I don't know why. I think it might be eyesight issues or just the fact that we live in such solitude out here in the countryside. But when I was in London this week for book launch number one with Stephen Brin's book, I've just felt terrible. I just couldn't handle the bewildering speed of it all anymore. And I lived there for years. So it just, it's a very odd experience.
I think it's both things, actually. I think it's partly that you're not used to it because the bewildering speed of Newport, Shropshire doesn't quite sound right, does it?
No.
Whereas the bewildering speed of London, yes. And also, I mean, you know, I don't want to depress you, but you are getting a little bit older. When you were in your 20s, when you were zipping around London being a hotshot journalist.
That's true. Look, I mean, the fact is I find going to Waitrose in Newport stressful enough. Just negotiating the car park because it's, you know, it's full of mad drivers. But, yeah, I don't think London Book Fair necessarily serves a purpose for us this year. But
not to justify the expense, certainly of staying in a hotel for 3 nights.
It's a lot of money. But, you know, we could do it in down and up in a day. With, you know, it's possible from here.
It's possible. We can do it because the train service is brilliant. So we can if we want to. We'll discuss it off air.
Well, let's look at what's on offer and decide.
So talking to London Book Fair, I have another news item. And I haven't actually told you about this one because I've only just found it.
Oh, gee, thanks.
No, but...
All right.
So last year at the London Book Fair, we went to a rights day, didn't we?
Yes, we did, yeah.
And we met a lovely lady there called Rachel Atkins, had fairly recently set up her micro press, Lemon Quartz Publishing.
That's right, yeah.
Well, it's in the bookseller. She was in the bookseller this week because she's decided that she can't continue her company because it hasn't been viable. So that's a little bit of sad news because we met Rachel and we talked to her at length.
Yeah.
And I actually wrote to her with my Writers and Artists Yearbook hat on a couple of months ago, suggesting she put the company in the yearbook, but... sadly not. It's not going to happen. It's gutting. It really is. So her company publishes sort of mind, body, spirit books.
Yeah, I remember. Very, very.
She still wants to work in that area. So it looks like she's looking at other publishers to get work in that area. Mm. So
I'm sorry to
hear
that.
So I think it's she had a good go and it just didn't work.
It's no, as we keep saying here, we're not going to fib about it. I mean, it's tough. It's really tough to turn a coin in this business at the moment. And as I say, much more established companies than our own are battling to do so. And if it weren't for the freelance income that we're making, you know, based on some of the skills that we've developed through Hoback, we would be, you know, probably in a not dissimilar position at times.
Yeah.
You know, there have been wobbles over the year. So,
being honest, month by month, we are living often. And it's because we've had a good couple of months, like you say, freelance income coming in. We've managed to put that back into the company.
Yes. We're investing everything. I mean, everything I've done on these Roman books, which I've talked to you about over the last few weeks, is going back into the company. I'm not seeing that money, personally.
No.
So, you know, I'm conscious of that when I'm, you know, I did my fourth chapter just now and practically wrecked my voice. Yet another great big battle scene. And, you know, that's the nature of it. So let's not beat around the bush.
No, I think we're lucky at the moment. So we do feel for Rachel because we met her and she's lovely and she had lots of hope and lots of ideas. But it's
I'd
just
be very interested to know how many people from that rights day actually made any progress in the rights situation because... You know, we've reached out to rights agents who could make a difference. And the word that we've got back since that particular time is that it's a really dead marketplace at the moment. And you really have to be a mega seller on Amazon, proven track record, top 100, that kind of thing, to get anywhere near. a rights deal right now and foreign rights, which is unheard of. But then there's also been, and we've seen this announced in the last few months, this big retraction where everyone was, TV and film rights were, you know, I wouldn't say flying 18 months ago or so. But that market has completely dried up because the content creators have overcommitted to a lot of productions and they're not getting the subscriber base to sustain it. So, you know, while there was a glut of new services coming in, Paramount Plus, Disney, and Apple, on top of Netflix and Amazon, those five platforms were driving a lot of sales of potential projects, and they're all getting shelved and they're withdrawing from that marketplace. And that has a chill.
Absolutely.
And an impact on people's, you know, I mean, that's a very big part of the agents' incomes, and that's dried up for them too. So no one really is out there sort of saying, you know, snapping your hands off for stuff.
No.
And that is probably...
We still have all our hands.
Yes. I think that's going to be a theme of London Book Fair, if I'm honest. But as I say, I don't think necessarily it's a natural environment for us to operate. And if we did go, it would be with the purpose of reflecting it for the podcast.
Yes.
And therefore having conversations that can benefit Hoback and Arch Publishing Services, potentially. But the podcast is the way that moves forward.
Yes, indeed. Because that's what we've got at the London Book Fair in the past, is great interviews and conversations.
Yeah, and things have developed from there, but we will see. It's only, you know, we've got to make a decision in the next week or so.
But they keep emailing me saying you haven't bought your ticket yet.
No, so. I know. And it's funny because we were recommending going to the London Book Fair for all the students at Exeter we spoke to, which brings us around to another story that you've got, I think, about the changes at Penguin Random House in terms of internships.
Oh, so yeah, another story I saw was that, I'm not sure how many years they've had this summer scheme going, but it's quite popular amongst young people who want to get into publishing because it offers a scheme where you work at Penguin Random House for the summer and, you know, obviously it opens doors or potentially opens doors. Well, they've just decided for the first time that they're going to restrict the system to people with a low socioeconomic background. Now, we were talking about this and we were saying, well, how do you decide that? You know, what's the benchmark? And also, what's the sort of evidence that you... Because there's so many sort of levels, isn't there, of your socioeconomic background. It's not just what your parents earn or...
Well, I mean...
But, okay, talking personally, my eldest child gets the full student loan for the same reason.
Yes, That's true.
Not that my ex-husband was a rock star. But
this is what I'm saying is that, you know, that for them to be able to judge, you know, where people are on that socioeconomic scale, there will be ways of gaming that system and getting those internships for people who perhaps don't need it. But look, it's hard to say, really. I mean, look, it's a step in the right direction from one point of view, in the sense that, yeah, publishing has a problem, whereas... You know, people who can take internships can afford to do them because mum and daddy can, you know.
Or they've got relatives, they stay within London, which I felt that.
Yeah, and I think that's very true for people in your sort of home counties who can, you know, afford a train ticket in, you know, they can do this sort of thing. But for anyone of a certain distance away with no connections, they can't. Mm. So that should help, but it'll be interesting to see how that works. We watch that with interest. Okay, and the story I wanted to touch on before we get to our interview with Brendan and Steve is, let me just dig it out. It was on my... There we are. Now, we talked about, at some length and with my hackles up, the changes to Roald Dahl books a few weeks ago. Remember that they were sensitivity readers had gone in and made 600 changes to Roald Dahl books to make them... less offensive for young minds. And they did something similar with Ian Fleming's books, the Bond books. And now, you'll never guess who's getting the treatment next.
Okay, should I try and guess?
Yeah, you will guess.
Well, I think it's related to crime, since we are a crime podcast. And I'm going to say the lovely Aunt Agatha.
Well, yes, Agatha Christie. Now, you know, Eagle listening members of our podcast community will remember our visit to Exeter University on a previous occasion last year, where we went to go and look at her correspondence.
We did.
With her agent, which is kept at a special collection in Exeter University. And it was fascinating because she worried about the minorest details and indeed was very, very strong on making sure that what she wrote was what got published. She was not keen on too many changes. So, subsequently, we are now getting a situation where HarperCollins, who currently publish Agatha Christie's estate and all the plays and the myriad books, have put the books through sensitivity readers again and are making changes.
I find this quite surprising, just on what you just said, as in Agatha Christie had quite a tight hold on her words. So how did they get that authorised?
Well, presumably the Christie Trust have been involved because they're very litigious.
That's what
Well, I watched this with bated breath. Anyway, so this is an article in Daily Telegraph today. This is Sunday we're recording this. Digital versions of new editions seen by the Telegraph include scores of text changes to the books written between 1920 and 1976, stripping them of numerous passages containing descriptions, insults or references to ethnicity, particularly for characters Christie's protagonists encounter outside the UK. The author's own narration, often through the inner monologue of Miss Jane Marple or Hercule Poirot, has been altered in many instances. Sections of dialogue uttered by often unsympathetic characters within the mysteries have also been cut. So, here's an example. In 1937, the Poirot novel, Death on the Nile, probably arguably the most famous of all of the books, the character of Mrs. Allerton, complains that a group of children are pestering her, saying that they come back and stare, and their eyes are simply disgusting, and so are their noses, and I don't believe I really like children. And this has been stripped back in a new edition to state, they come back and stare, and I don't believe I really like children. I don't see how that's offensive.
There's a subtle difference.
Vocabulary has also been altered, with the term Oriental removed. Other descriptions have been altered in some instances, with a black servant originally described as grinning, as he understands the need to stay silent about an incident, described as neither black nor smiling, but simply nodding.
Oh, I grin when I understand the need to be silent.
And in a new edition of the 1964 Miss Marple novel, A Caribbean Mystery, the amateur detective's musing that a West Indian hotel worker smiling at her had such lovely white teeth has been removed, with such similar references to beautiful teeth also taken out. Okay, so you get the, you get the gist of it.
It just makes me feel tired.
Yeah. Yeah, that's how I feel, really.
I'm just tired of it now.
I felt more strongly about the Roald Dahl stuff, if I'm honest. But you, because, you know, you take away those descriptions. I mean, they're pretty lazy descriptions from Agatha Christie. And yes, they are a time capsule reflection of a woman who grew up, you know, born at the turn of the 19th century into the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
From a position of initial privilege with servants and things like that, and then fell on hard times, as we discussed before. Then gave gallant service as a nurse during the First World War, and then discovered her writing talent just after the war. And always was very, very concerned about money and her reputation and her legacy. So I don't think, though, that she would have had any... I mean, I don't think culturally there was any problem saying these things at that time. And I think, in a sense, Agatha Christie is all about its time and context and you know, society. So changing those things seems odd to me.
Well, it's the same as you could say any time in history where we've had books, you could say the same thing. It's written at that time for the time, and it should be preserved in for that, because it's culturally interesting to see how people felt and thought and the language they used.
And this sort of sensitivity reader airbrushing of things.
Just tired of it.
Totally. I mean, where does it stop? And why has it started in the first place? Is something that you could argue. Anyway, this is not going to be an issue that we're going to face with our next guests.
Great connection there.
Yeah, sorry, it was the worst handbrake turn of a segue I've ever made. But I'm just going to, by way of introduction, so let's just explain the context. When you first encountered Bryn and Steve and the manuscript, where it got to,
yeah,
with transformational selling.
Okay, so it was about a year ago. I'm registered with a website called Readsy, where if you're a freelance editor, you can register, and it's quite a high vetting process. And I registered as a non-fiction academic copy editor and proofreader. And Bryn and Steve approached me and a number of other people as well, saying we're looking for a copy editor for our business book. So I replied and said, oh, okay, I'm quite interested. I'll do a sample edit for you and let me know what you think. Did the sample edit. They liked it. We had a Zoom call and they chose me. I was very happy at that point. So for the next 2 months or so, I embarked on the edit of this book. And it had been through a development editor, but I don't know much about that, what happened, what they suggested. But I found this book was a little bit chaotic. There was a structure to it, but it wasn't quite gelling yet together. There was a lot in there that they wanted to say, but the message just needed to be tightened up a bit and made it a little bit more clear. So that's what I did. And at the end of the process, Bryn and Steve said, we want to publish our book, but we haven't got a clue how we're going to go about this. And I said, well, if you choose to self-publish, let me know, because I might be able to help you. And I left it at that. Didn't hear anything for 6 months. Then they popped up again and they said, we want to publish our book. We want to do it in about 4 months. So I pitched to them what we could do for them between the two of us. You could do the narration of the audiobook. I could format the book, design the cover, arrange for it to become an ebook available on Amazon, arrange for the printing, however they wanted it, whether they wanted it on Amazon or whether they wanted it wide, you know, available in more places. And they said yes, and so we did, and it published last 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, it's been it's quite a journey, and it's been a real pleasure to work with Bryn and Steve. So they have 70 years of sales experience, particularly around business-to-business sales services and things like that, which have been fascinating. Weaved within the book, so they have a philosophy, transformational selling, taking selling to a new direction based on all sorts of new factors which they discuss. But at the heart of it are their anecdotes and their stories about their own selling experience, which is fascinating. And in the audiobook version, which is coming out soon enough, they have narrated their own anecdotes, which has been great. But as you'll hear, they're great storytellers, and it has been a pleasure to work with them. So let's speak to Bryn Thompson and Steve Lowndes. What a great pleasure it is to be speaking to Bryn Thompson and Steve Lowndes. Thanks for joining us, guys.
Morning.
Absolute pleasure.
Thank you. And it's been a week for you, hasn't it, really? Because you've launched, it's already out available, but you've had your two launches for Transformational Selling, which is your new book and the product of many years of thought and work. So how did that feel, Bryn?
Yeah, surreal in a way. I mean, all the time we've spent from when we first planned it, which was about 12 years ago, to when we started writing it, which was early in lockdown. We finally got there to actually physically see that book in print, and then to have, I think, best part of 100 people come to two launches over the last two evenings. It was great, really, really buzzing.
It is, and Steve, take us through that thing, because we were talking about 12 years ago. When was the spark for this project? When was that sort of created?
Yeah, funnily, it all started. Bryn and I were working away. I think we'd been colleagues for about a year or so by that particular point. But I don't think we'd ever worked really together on a project. And we were away in Dallas over there with a client who's a business. And I think we'd got there. It was a Saturday. We're downtown Dallas, and it's if you go downtown, because it's such a business center focus, the place was dead. It was like someone had dropped the bomb, and it was just like literally just walking around this city. It was really kind of unnerving, actually. So we stopped, but it was incredibly hot. So we just dived into the first bar that we could find that was actually open. And there weren't many places that were open. And we were just sat in there. We were talking sales, and it just sort of cropped up, this idea. Do you know what? We've got so many ideas to share. And I can't remember who said it, but it'll probably be, I'll claim it was me. And I think we should write a book. But anyway, that was where it sort of started. And I think we had a couple of full starts, and we put some ideas together, and life got in the way. And yeah, it sort of sat there as an idea, and we kept coming around to it. You know, we should really write that book. We should get on and write that book. And I think 2020, we said, right, this is the year we're going to do it. And we actually physically made a start. We mapped it out again, and we went, right, let's start again. Let's do this. And then, of course, lockdown hit, and there was no excuse not to do it. So, yeah, it was kind of 10 years in that we should get on with this, and then 3 years in the actually doing it.
That's fascinating. I mean, Bryn, I'm interested to know which of you was leading that process in terms of we should do it. Was it a mutual thing every time you saw each other and you went,
I think I've always had a kind of writer in me, and I think, you know, everybody says they have a book in them, but it was always an ambition of mine at some point to write a book. But there's a limited number of subjects I could probably write a book on, and Steve is really, I guess, somebody who's got a lot of very creative ideas about learning and development. And so actually collaborating with somebody, given the fact that essentially my career has been 40 years, I have to say, in sales, mainly probably the last 30 as a sales director, actually collaborating with somebody who'd got that theoretical background to add to the practical stuff that we both could bring to the party. I think it was really very, very much a joint effort, really. I think Steve said, finally, let's do something. And we actually planned it just before lockdown, to be fair, but lockdown became the catalyst to actually be able to have some time to get on and write it, because there wasn't a lot else to do.
No. I think lockdown has produced quite a lot of books, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's one of the good things, one of the few good things, I think, that came out of lockdown.
Well, I think so interesting, because I've narrated this book, so I know it well now. Obviously,
and I've read it a few times.
Well, you have. You're the editor, and I ought to really be interviewing you as well, Rebecca, as part of that when we got to that point in the process. But what's so interesting is that balance you've struck, guys, between the anecdotal, the stuff from your careers, which, as you mentioned during the week, it's 70 years of sales experience between you. That's extraordinary. And using those anecdotes and that sort of real world experience, but then matching it with actually coming up with something which is a new way of looking at the sales process. And what we're talking about in particular is selling between businesses, business to businesses, or B2B, as it's described. That's not an easy thing to achieve, to marry the two elements, getting, you know, a clear proposition for your reader to go away with some practical things to do, but also making it human.
Yeah, Steve, do you want to pick that one up?
Yeah, I mean, that's probably where the sort of strength came in, because we both brought slightly different things to that. So Bryn's always been a really, you know, great storyteller, and yeah, well, you'll know this because you've read that. But, you know, whenever there's something, there's always, you know, there's a story, there's an anecdote, there's something in there that really brings it to life. And storytelling is really, really important. And it's important in sales, and it's important in training. It's important in developing people. We know it's, you know, it's the fundamental way that people have communicated for thousands of years. Everything's passed down through story. So what was really nice was just, and I think we kind of settled into a bit of a rhythm where I went, well, here's the sort of content and some of the theory, the ideas and the observations that we've made. And then Bryn was mainly adding the stories in and going, right, well, let me put these in. And so it kind of worked like that. So it was more a case of, well, I'll put that framework in. You write some of the stories, then we'll kind of swap around. Maybe I'll put a couple of mine in as well, and you can put your take on some of the theories. But it seemed to work really nicely, that fit, because we both brought a slightly different element to the way in which the book was written. So
yeah, and what I love is you can hear the two voices, and you do have slightly different voices in the book, but they do go well together. And as a reader, it flows from one to the other. And I like the fact that it's broken up and then suddenly there's in a box, Bryn. Well, one time I blah, 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 blah. Yeah. And you, as a reader, you think, that's fantastic. That illustrates what was just being in the previous section. And that gives me hope that, you know, about what you're saying. So,
yeah, I think it's interesting, actually. One of our beta readers when we started the book is Helen Boothby, who was at the launch on Thursday night. And H, as she's commonly known, was a colleague of ours for over 10 years now. She said something interesting that sort of reflects your point there, Rebecca, which is, I can tell when it's Steve talking and I can tell when it's you talking. But I think over time, given the fact that we've edited and edited, we've had a development editor look at it, we've had you look at it from a proofing and an editorial point of view as well, I think in time, I've almost forgotten the bits that I've written and Steve's written because it's become much more of a collaboration. But I think the difference is Steve, I always say, is like the guy who was classically trained. If it was a pianist, he'd be like the classically trained at the Royal Academy of Music, whereas I was the person who learned how to knock out a tune when I was 15. You know, that's probably the analogy as to the two things we bring to the table. But just to add to that, one thing that I think is really important is between us. I mean, my background sales training was in sales recruitment, and collectively over those 70 years, oh my word, I would think we must have interviewed, assessed, trained and developed well over 20,000 salespeople. So there were so many things that were in our heads as to what, why is it most of those people that, no disrespect to them, were not as good as, you know, we would have wanted them to have been, mainly because they hadn't had a lot of formal training. A lot of what came out of the book was, what is it that they're doing now and what do they need to do differently to be successful?
Yeah, and that's really the crux of this, isn't it? Because you quote and you mention certain books that have changed the approach to selling over the years, and I suppose the last big tidal wave of change was the Challenger sale, which was a massive hit and adopted by a lot of companies. And it was a move away from what you describe as transactional selling, which is just get the sale done, you know, get the signature and provide the widget or the service and not take it any further than that, really. You know, it's just simply about making your quarterly figures and all that sort of behavior. The Challenger sale takes it further, but what is it that about your work, Steve, that is taking it even further than that? Because people listening to this will perhaps not understand what it is you're proposing here.
Yes, it's great. I mean, I guess what we're looking at is recognizing that, I think, particularly in B2B sales, but actually you see it across all kinds of sales and all going out there, there's a change really in terms of the dynamic between customer and supplier, if you want to think about it. And there's a number of things that are changing that dynamic. One of the main things is the fact that, and this is increasingly happening across B2B and B2C worlds, is this change of the traditional sort of sales paradigm, which is, well, I give you a product and you give me cash, and then we part ways. And if you think about it, you know, 20 years ago, you bought a CD. If you wanted an album, you bought a CD, or you... people still buy the vinyl, I suppose. Or you bought a DVD if you wanted to watch a film or whatever. Now you subscribe to Netflix. Now you subscribe to Spotify. And you don't, and you have access to all the things that you want to have access to until you stop paying that subscription. And suddenly the dynamics change, because it's no longer a case you go, well, actually, if you're no longer quite providing me with what I need, I can turn it on, I can turn it off again. I'm not now buying something outright. And software is a really classic example of that, particularly in the business world, where people are now subscribing to software. You know, this laptop we're doing right now is, you know, we haven't, you know, we're here on Zoom, but you're paying a subscription to Zoom. You haven't put the license outright and gone, right, you carry Zoom forever. No, you pay a subscription. The day you stop paying that subscription, you stop getting the service. And what that's changed is, and there's a massive dynamic that's suddenly changed there, because it says, as a salesperson, I can now no longer sell you the shiny item. you pay for it, and then we go, but I don't care whether you use it or not. It's up to you. You bought the shine, but whether it delivers anything or not doesn't really matter so much, because now we're only going to make money as a business if what I've sold you, you continue to use, and it delivers what you needed it to. So as a salesperson, I really have to get under that, not what's going to make you buy it now, but what's going to make you want to stay with it moving forward. And it's just that change of emphasis around you're buying stuff because there's an ultimate outcome that you want to try and achieve. And as a seller, I've got to really understand what it is. And I've got to change the dynamic in the way that we sell. You know, Bryn talks about this a lot, and we talk about it a lot in the book, that the seller-buyer dynamic has changed massively now. And sellers no longer have to be and shouldn't be subservient to customers, because we're entering into a long-term relationship. We should be doing it on an equal footing. So it's about having that mindset and changing the language and everything about the way that we sell that says we're coming into this as partners. And we're working together to try and achieve a longer term outcome. And it's that kind of focus that we really try to emphasize throughout the book.
I'm fascinated, Brian. I mean, because you know, you've been through those different eras of selling over those 40 years. And some of your anecdotes are about that previous sort of paradigm where, you know, you just get the thing across the line and satisfy your sales manager and all that sort of thing. How difficult has it been to, I mean, you've been obviously very adaptable, but were there sort of moments where you realized that things had shifted and that you've had to change your mindset to adapt?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I've always borne in mind is if I'm working with a customer, I want to work with them for a long period of time. And I have managed to develop long-term client relationships. You may remember at the London, Martin Ward was there. Martin's just been appointed the West Midlands Tech Commission.
Yes.
I first placed Martin in a job in, I think, about 1989 or 90 as a very young pre-sales consultant. And he went on to have a stellar career where he became a client over the years. And I still do work with him today. So I think the principle of building those longer term relationships for mutual benefit has always been something dear to my heart. And not all salespeople perhaps have that mentality. So that's helped. But for sure, you constantly have to adapt your way of working in what we term the new world to be relevant. And I think the one thing that underpins it all, And I came up with a sort of saying that we put in the book, which is don't be a Labrador. Don't just let the client constantly throw the slipper. As much as I love Labradors, they're great dogs. Too many salespeople have this master-servant relationship where the client asks for more and you just deliver it without always getting something back in return. So I think the big focus really on the fostering collaboration element of the book is see your client as an equal. Now, that doesn't mean you don't respect them, you don't work hard for them to give success, but you don't have to bow and scrape to them all the time. You need to make sure your time is as important as theirs, and they're committing to actions along the way as part of the process.
But in a way, I think what you're talking about respect, I think it's actually you're respecting the client more because you're listening to them. And so that is showing that you're respecting their opinion and, you know, their feedback on what they want from you. So yeah.
Well, I think the thing I took away from it, and you know, we're in a B2C company, Hobeck Books is providing, and indeed Arch Publishing, for which, you know, this has been our sort of foundational project, if you like. One of the things I took away from it is this thing of two things, really. Steve, you've come up with, in a practical sense, you're encouraging sellers to ask questions to get to the bottom of what a customer really needs and what their aim is at the end of the process. And Bryn, there's quite a lot where you're talking about making sure that in those conversations, everyone knows that they have to contribute to the next step, so that they're invested. They're not just being passive as customers. You call it the belay model in your section, Bryn. So tell us what's the thinking there and how that mental image works.
Well, I can remember the exact moment that I came up with this idea, because we, back in our Pareto days, we used to run London Assessment Days every Wednesday down near Chiswick. We had an office there, and we used to, about 6 o'clock, decamp to the pub. And it was a lovely summer's day, and we were just sitting outside with a very nice chilled glass of white wine or two. And I guess, as Steve said, I was probably just in storytelling mode. And all I could think of was, I said, does anybody recall that time when you had a meeting with a client and you thought, what a great meeting? And 3 weeks later, you're trying to get hold of that client, you're trying to email them, call them, they don't respond, and you never, ever have contact with them again. Everybody went, yeah, I've had that meeting. It was such a kind of universal thing. I said, what's going wrong there? There's something. And I was thinking of the analogy of climbing a mountain, that sales is, you know, getting to the top of the mountain is really what we're aiming for. And what does a climber do? A climber hammers something into a rock. And I didn't really know the name of this. Mm. So I had to kind of Google it, and I realised it was a belay, or a belay, as probably the Americans would call it.
Yeah.
So the people were looking at me quite strangely, like, what the hell's he going on about? Anyway, over, I don't know, the last 10 years or so since I came up with it, there's a few companies now talk about Brin's belays. No, it's sort of stuck, really, and it's all about, how do we get the client at the end of every interaction or intervention to commit to the next action? And the more of that that they do, the more we can secure our place higher up that mountain, or towards what we're trying to achieve.
Mm.
That's the principle.
Fascinating.
You know, you're famous when you've got a theory named after you.
Steve's written most of the other models, may I say, but I'm claiming that one.
That one is yours, definitely.
we'll talk about the process of when we got involved and where things have got to now, and actually getting the book out shortly. But just going back over something that you both said about interviewing potential salespeople and placing them and all that sort of 20,000 potential salespeople. I'm fascinated to know what characteristics you're looking for in that process. Is there a sort of an ideal type, or can you see glints of gold in different personality types? Steve?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I've done less on the recruitment side, but obviously a lot more on the training and the assessment around that. And obviously bring a lad from the sort of recruitment point of view.
Mm.
I think the biggest thing, and we talk a little bit about this, is this difference between sort of action zone and comfort zone.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I'm really looking for. When it boils down to it, you look at people who go, how many people are prepared to do the uncomfortable stuff? Okay. And that might just be as simple as, you know, picking up the phone rather than sending out an email, because we can send out an email and that's really easy. But actually picking up the phone and having that conversation is a little bit tougher. Or the people who are prepared to go, you know, there'll be times when you look and say, and it's back to the point you made earlier about having that equity in the relationship. And sometimes it means you've got to ask a very tough question of your client. But it's that's going to really open up the doors and get them to move forward. And you can see those that go, okay, that's going to be an uncomfortable question to ask, but I see why I need to do it, and I'm going to do it. And those that go, ooh, I don't think they'd like that. Oh, I don't think my clients would like that. Well, it's not about them liking that. It's about asking that really tough question. Otherwise, what's going to happen is you're going to skirt around the issue. You're not going to have that difficult conversation. And you're going to end up, as Brin was saying before, without those belays, where that client's ghosting you for the next 3 or 4 weeks. You go, well, what happened? And it's like, well, you know, because you didn't ask that really tough question about, you know, and it might be just as simple as, look, we're having this conversation. Are you genuinely interested in moving forward? Is this genuinely something you can see happen in your business, or is it not? And if it's not, that's okay, I can move on. But lots of people don't want to have that question or ask that question, because sometimes we're a bit fearful of what the answer might be, so we'll move away from it. That's the thing for me. So it's there's a piece in there about action zone comfort. I'm just looking for people who go, yeah, all right, I get that, and it is uncomfortable, but I'm going to do it.
It's a bit like when you go out with someone and you ask, do you want kids?
Wow.
Say no, you move on.
Yeah, I mean, look, I've heard anecdotally from guys, you know, this is about 10, 15 years ago. So we're talking about women who are approaching a point, you know, mid-30s, maybe late, you know, early 40s. And guys were out there on Tinder or whatever dating. And that was the first question. I remember a very famous sports presenter said to me that his wife had broken up with him. And so he got out there back into the scene and he went through Guardian Soulmates. And he met up with this very, you know, beautifully turned out Italian woman, very, you know, posh. In Sloane Square they met, and she said, first question, have you had the snip? That was all
she was... could sell her then.
Yeah. Because, you know, if he couldn't provide the kids, then she wasn't interested. That was it. And so that relationship didn't last more than about 10 minutes, I don't think. But
it's wasted, is it? 10 minutes of your
life? Fair enough. But I don't know how we've done that, you know, as ever. With
that's
the
my fault.
Yeah, the podcast comes down here. But I want to go back to you, Bryn, because, you know, you're sitting across, you know, the interview panel looking for potential. And the reason I ask this question is because I met some of the guys who've gone through your hands as trainers at your launch in Mayfair on Wednesday.
Yeah.
And, you know, these guys are, they were probably late 20s, early 30s. And all of them, and I was sort of challenging them and saying, you know, this book's brilliant, by the way. And, you know, I'm sure, you know, you've heard some of these stories, but you've got to read it. And they were saying, oh, we're waiting for the audio version, which was quite flattering. pressure, yeah, exactly. But they were saying, Bryn and Steve changed everything. And we have changed our entire approach to everything. So, and it was when I got them onto the subject of settling, suddenly the sort of the joviality went away. It became, they were really focused. I was really
interested,
struck by that. Mm. So that's a credit to you guys. But, you know, going back to that recruitment side of thing, can you see that? Is that what you're probing for? Someone who can laser focus in on the sale?
Yeah, I definitely think focus is important. I think there's a misnomer attached to what a good salesperson looks like for people outside of the industry.
Yeah.
You always kind of say, oh, they've got the gift of the gab, they've got a big personality, they love to talk. Now, it's interesting you sort of use a kind of dating analogy, because a business meeting is a bit like a date, really, that if you went on a date and you said to your friend, how was your date? And you said, oh, well, they just talked the whole time. It probably wouldn't be a very good date.
Yeah.
It's exactly the same in sales. And there's far too many sellers who don't use the principle of two ears and one mouth and use them in that order. And it doesn't, you don't have to be some massive extrovert, even though probably people would say I am. Somebody who's really good wanting to know more about a business and really trying to get under the skin of it, as Steve says, not being frightened sometimes to ask quite challenging questions. And I think where sales has really moved over the many years I've been involved in it is you're much more of a consultant these days to help a business to move forward in the right direction. How can we actually do stuff that's going to impact your business? How can make your business better? And also, how can we make your customer's business better? So not That's just true. Your customer, but your customer's customer. Once you start to create those links and people with those kind of skill sets who are good at understanding and being able to then match back a solution that really fits that problem and achieves those business outcomes, that requires not just a big personality, it requires a whole raft of skills that aren't developed overnight. And I think, you know, people go into sales roles, they get a couple of days of induction training and are expected to go and become world beaters. That's not going to happen. No other profession in the world allows you loose in the marketplace without giving you loads and loads of training and guidance to get you there. So I think that's the key for me is you know, you never stop learning, and you need to have a real structure to what you do, but it needs to be underpinned by an unshakable belief and a real desire to want to improve your customer's business. Those people who just want to make a sale, they're never going to get a lot of repeat business.
You've got to be authentic.
Yeah, and that's critical. I think people can see through you if they don't trust you, if you lack credibility. It's not that difficult to see through somebody who's just trying to sell you something.
Well, it perhaps brings us round to the, I mean, this bizarre sort of conversation in the sense that, you know, you are our clients and we have sold to you.
I had to pitch to you.
Yeah.
I do confess I was a little nervous.
Now, this is something that is perhaps, you know, something that isn't really in a Rebecca's natural sphere, really. So, you know, you can't get a seller sort of thing. But nonetheless,
I don't know what you're saying, Ben.
Well, this relationship's been a year now, creative relationship between, you know, when you first started editing.
It's coming up to a year, yeah. It was spring, wasn't it, last year?
So. What I'm interested in is, guys, I mean, you'd had your developmental edit by this point, but when Rebecca got the manuscript, she remembers it being sort of 90,000 words at that point, was it? Something like that?
Was it? I honestly can't remember how many.
It probably was a lot.
It was big.
One of your requirements was to tighten it up a bit.
Yeah.
Because someone had said that, you know, that it's a bit on the long side or something. So that was one of the things in my head when I was reading it.
Right. So I'm going to ask you a question.
Okay.
You've worked in nonfiction a lot. A lot of it's academic.
Yes.
You're faced with a business book for the first time.
Of this sort. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
What was your approach? What was your thinking when you saw that? And in terms of just relating it back to what we're talking about, which is this discovery process of asking the right questions of your clients, did you do that?
Not initially with the editing side of things, because that is a very specific request from you two. You wanted it edited. It had a development edit, so you wanted a sort of a structural copy edit to sort of polish it almost. So I knew what you wanted. So I didn't really ask that many questions at that stage. It was when you said, now we want to turn it into a book. That was when I had absorbed things I'd learned from your book. I wrote you a long email and I broke it all down into with some questions as well as what are you looking to get out of publishing your book? Where are your customers? That sort of thing. So yes, I did. Yeah.
And so, as the recipients of that, you know, that email and that input, Bryn, what was your thinking when you've received that? And in fact, it's really a question to both of you, but let's start with you, Bryn.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons why we've enjoyed this sort of past year working with you is we want honesty. We want somebody to tell us if we think something's too long or the style. I think there's probably only a couple of things we push back on that you'd said.
Yeah,
now we want
yeah
to keep
you're very it. Good, yeah. Clients.
But most times we're like, okay, we get it. I think the world's always about looking to find experts to do things that you don't do as well as what you do on a day-to-day basis. And what's been great about this experience for us is we knew very little about publishing, and we'd been kind of ruminating about how we're going to get this book to market and everything else, and much more succinctly and in a much better organized way, we've just kind of thrown the issue at you. I don't think you quite realized we wanted you to do everything, like just make it happen for us, and that's been great because it's just taken the hassle out of it. We can get on with our day job. And it's very similar to when you think about why you bring somebody into your business if you're looking to buy something. You go through a very similar process and exercise. And I can't remember who it was now. It was one of the sort of gurus like an Anthony Robbins or Tom Peters who once said, he said, talking to a client, and this client said, I believe you could and probably should outsource everything that you aren't specialist in.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And what about you, Slay? I mean, you know, clearly a lot of your contribution was around this sort of putting the framework in. And I mean, I'm interested to know, Rebecca, when you were working on that framework, you know, how that side of things worked in the edit.
Well, I mean, I did make a lot of suggestions. So I read it, first of all, I read it once all the way through and edited it, did a traditional edit on it, and lots of suggestions and questions as well. Because sometimes I thought, as a reader,
Because I think I read it. I've read a lot of marketing business books for our company.
Mm.
And so I was reading it as a reader, wanting to learn more about the subject. And so when I didn't understand something, even if someone who is reading your book may understand it, I would question it just in case, you know, some of the terminology you did explain, you know, actually, no, this is.
But I suppose my point is, Steve, you know, when you get an edit back, because I've had bits of editing stuff, the initial reaction for most people is, well, because you've done your best. You think you've got it to, you know, pretty good. And you want what you're looking for, perhaps some people think, is a bit of praise here and there. But I mean, what you're actually getting is a lot of things, challenges.
What you want, and this is actually fundamental to the whole idea of transformational selling. Well, yeah. What you want is a bit of praise. What you need is someone who's going to tell you the tough stuff that you didn't want to hear.
Yeah.
Sit back and reflect. And that's kind of exactly the same way. It works exactly. Brim saying, you bring the expert in, you know, and I think we talk about this in the book, you know, you don't go and see the doctor and say, can you prescribe this to me? You say, here's my symptoms. And the doctor says, let me do the prescriptions. I'll tell you what you need. You know, we don't go to our accountant or do this and do that. And our accountant says, no, you know, my job is to get you doing this, put that, keep you legal, do all the right things. I'll tell you what, you know, the best things are. And I'll probably give you some options. And I'll say, well, you could do it this way. And here's the pros and cons. That's what you're looking for. That's why you bring an expert in. And that's really where, you know, we saw selling going. But I guess we have to be on the receiving end, act like the clients that we want people to sell it in exactly the same way. But actually, it was really good because all the edits we had, you know, we had the first developmental edit that came back and said, really positive. Well, you guys have got a lot of work to do because you've got to decide what type of book this is. And it's a bit mixed because you've written two. So, and that was, I remember Bryn and I sitting down going, it was both brilliant and devastating at the same time in terms of we went, it's so right and it's brilliant and we can see a vision where we've got to go to. We just got, oh my God, there's so much more work to do. And obviously when Rebecca went through it, you know, what was great is, you know, all practically all, I think there was one or two bits we went, do you know what? I quite like that. I'm just going to leave it in. So do that. But most of what came back, I was like, okay, it's coming from, this is an expert telling us we should do this. An expert saying we should probably put it in this particular way. And actually even that bit, and you were saying, Rebecca, you're coming back going, this piece of terminology, I don't understand it. And our automatic thing was, well, yeah, but if you're in sales, you'd understand. And then suddenly we went, maybe we're making too many assumptions here. And actually, if you're asking the question going, I'm not quite getting this, we've got to go back and go, is this genuine? And it just made us reflect and challenge our own thinking a little bit around, well, actually, are we being a bit too insular with our language? And do we have to make it a bit more inclusive so that, you know, we're making too many assumptions about what our audience already knows. And the fact that, you know, we talk about these things every day, but even our audience who are in sales may be not using this terminology. So actually, every time you asked the question and said, I don't know this term or I don't know what it is, it made us really stop and reflect and go, that's a really good point, because that's really what you need. You need someone who's going to open you up to the blind spots that you don't have or you're not aware of. So that was really valuable for us. But yeah, back to your point, Adrian. No, we didn't take, you know, actually we got quite good at not getting offended by it. Because we both realized we thought it was good. We knew it could be better, and that's why we wanted you guys
I think that's key, isn't it? Because I think as a writer, whether you're fiction or non-fiction, it's knowing that you can always be better.
Yeah. Well, may I say, as the narrator of the body of the book, if you like, I took a great deal from it, and I think that you have, and this is something I was saying to, you know, your attendees on Wednesday, that what you've managed to do collaboratively, but principally you guys, is to create an accessible book that has so many things that any business could take from it, but at the same time is very focused on that core selling business to business element. But it is so approachable as well. And I think that some of the feedback you've had is fantastic. And I before we do this interview, I will mention what Jem Duduku put on his LinkedIn, which was spectacular. So in the introduction, we shall talk about that. But gentlemen, it is approaching the time for the random question. I have one more serious question about the book, first of all, before we get to the random question, which is, you've done it now. You've got your book out there. How does it feel to actually have that in your hands? And what has the feedback been like so far? So, Bryn, how did that feel to be out there with piles of books?
Yeah, it felt great, actually. I think when you've sort of ticked a real bucket list item in your life, and it's always been one for me over many years, I've written articles and had things published in magazines over the years and stuff like that. But a book is a whole other ball game. So, and the first thing I did, and this sounds terrible, is I read it twice. I was in Spain and I'd taken the book with me, and I was like, I just need to read it to make sure it's okay. And it was that feeling after reading it, thinking, if I was a reader, I think I would enjoy this.
Yeah, that's good.
That feeling itself was great. It just sort of solidified all the effort and hours and many hours that we'd put into it. But to see other people's reactions, particularly you mentioned somebody like Jem and Andy Bounds, who's written a foreword, who's a real guru in our industry, and was more than happy without a minute's thought to write the foreword, and said he thought it was beautifully written. He's sent us lovely LinkedIn posts and emails since then saying, I think what you've done is great. Jem saying, and he's read many books and is an author himself, saying, you know, it's the best sales book I've ever read. I mean, you know, I don't think these are people who would deliberately blow smoke. So
no.
When they're fellow professionals, means a heck of a lot. Even more for us is the fact that if salespeople start to read it, as we know they're going to be doing over the next few weeks, and we start to see not only reviews, but how they're using it. I did a presentation to about 50 salespeople last week, and their head of training said, we're already using some of these concepts. The talk you gave, which was all about the book, has gone down really well. We're all already using them practically in our day-to-day work. That's the sort of acid test for us as to how it takes root.
Yeah, because you don't just want them to read it. You want them to use it, don't you?
Yeah.
Exactly.
And how about
pretty much a how-to book.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think the one bit that sticks in my mind was actually Thursday morning after the launch, and Bryn and I were making our way back to the station to head back up north for our Thursday launch. And it was a lovely sunny morning and we're walking through. And I think, you know, because coming up to the launch, we'd just been hoping that it'd been a success, hoping that people would come and hoping people would love the book. And then we'd seen already the post that Jem had put and, you know, and I'm just walking through the sunshine and we're stopping for breakfast. And I just went, and it's just suddenly hit me. I went, I'm living the life of an author right now. It's like I'm strolling through London and we stopped for a nice breakfast. And this is how I always imagined being a successful author would be. It would be walks in the sunshine. I mean, you know, and leisurely talking about things and creating ideas that I would put down on paper later on in the day and stuff. So that was the moment it really felt real for me.
Wow.
I love that.
Bottle,
we all dream of that, yeah.
Bottle that moment. Right, yeah. let's bring this whole thing grinding to a halt. And we'll ask the question the challenging question that
used to be asked lots of questions.
Yeah, so this is it. So this is
the real test.
This is the ultimate question in British podcasting. It is Rebecca's random question.
Right, so I've actually got Bryn to thank for this question, because when you came up to Staffordshire to record your anecdotes, you recommended a book to me. Now, when people recommend a book, I often buy them, and it's this book here, which I'm showing, okay. But the people who are listening can't see it. It's called Sensational, A New Story of Our Senses. It's brilliant, so thank you. Right, and my question comes from this book. So there's a chapter about hearing, and I came across a word called misophonia. Now, misophonia is when you actually cannot stand a sound. It's so bad, you can't hear it, you can't stand it. So my question is to you, what is the worst, most obnoxious sound in your opinion, and why? Steve first.
Okay, I'm going to go with this one. I think this is because I'm getting a little bit older and I'm getting much, much grumpier. But I spend a lot of time on public transport, and I love going on the train and just reading a book or getting on some work and whatever. And I think there's two sounds that really annoy me when I'm on the train. The first one is just someone sniffing constantly. Yeah. And you get that sort of kind of, and it's just like, oh, God. That's the first one. And the second one is someone who's listening to music through headphones and I'm trying to work away and all I can hear is...
Yeah.
And it's just like... Yeah. Yeah, so that would be it. That would spoil my journey, basically, having those two things.
Absolutely.
Good sound.
I think, you know, I agree with you.
Oh, that's in bad sound.
The second one.
Yeah.
Oh, I hate that. Yeah, especially the way you did it then. That, yeah.
Perfect. And Bryn?
Well, if I stayed on the same theme of Steve there, mine is people who conduct conversations on trains very loudly in business. So that everyone can hear how important they are when I'm just trying to get on my laptop and do some work. There's a guy sitting opposite me the other day who must have been on the phone for an hour and a half telling him about how he was going to do this deal with the client, what a great sales guy he was, how he didn't really need his boss to give him any ideas. I mean, I was tempted to just, you know, pass a book over to the next carriage. You could see everybody kind of grating, and his voice was sort of getting louder and louder. And you know, because we're British, nobody goes over and says, "Please shut up," which, you know, one of these days I'm sure I will do. But that's one. Interestingly, I remember the vuvuzelas that were in South Africa at the World Cup. I once went to a presentation on marketing and said, what was the best seller at the 2010 World Cup in South Africa? And everybody went, vuvuzelas. The answer was no, it was cotton wool that people were in their ears to stop the vuvuzelas. So I thought that was pretty clever.
Yeah. That's very well put. Very well put.
How about you? Do you have a sound that you can
Well, there's two. I mean, we just had it during the podcast, which is when my microphone cable started rattling, and I'll have to throw it away and get another one. So that's not good. The other one is the voice of the woman who does the Vodafone adverts at the moment.
Oh, you know, the volume on the calm down. As soon as
something
she comes
about
on.
Modern British advertising where you have this burst of vapid energy from a younger voiceover person. Across the UK, that kind of approach. I can't stand it. The really fast advertising thing crammed into a radio adverts particularly. Can't bear it. I just can't. I mean, this fake, you know, youthful energy thing to sell stuff just isn't delivering for me, you know. And, you know, then, of course, I'm having done quite a few of these things myself. You have to do
the terms and conditions are
maybe risking if you don't, you know, that kind of stuff at the end. I mean, I, you know, basically, yeah, most radio adverts drive me nuts, and when it spills into TV, it's even worse. But you know, the best adverts are the ones that just have the minimum number of words and just convey it. And that also the other one, if it's not sound, it's a visual thing. The Lloyds Bank advert of all the black horses running around the place, can't bear it. Honestly, give me a break.
I think you've stirred a hornet's nest here, Rebecca.
Yeah, yeah,
looks like you have.
Oh, it's you. You're all rattling.
Oh, I'm rattling. Well, do you want to know what my sound is?
Yeah, go on.
So mine's quite boring, I think, in comparison. It's old men clearing their throat and spitting.
Johnny, just release your grip. Mm. Right.
There you go.
Just hold the microphone, not the cable.
Clearing their throat and spitting. Yeah.
That's
my wife has been on this interview. She clearly suffers from whatever that condition is because she's got ultra sensitive hearing. And even, you know, I could be two rooms away and she'd say, stop doing that. but anything that you've just mentioned, if we're out in a bar or a restaurant, she's like, we need to go and sit somewhere else. I'm like, what? Why? It's that person three tables away. Can't hear them grunting. Yeah,
wow.
Anything like that. She's, you know, it is almost a kind of condition, but I'm kind of glad I don't have that. I'm fairly oblivious generally to most sounds, but not somebody braying over the phone on a 2-hour train journey.
No,
yeah,
I don't think anyone likes that.
I love this. You know, it reminds me of Alan Partridge Christmas special when he's talking about and he's walking down a cloister in Norwich going 350k or we take it to Sky, that kind of conversation.
Yeah.
So
no commodities.
Yeah. Well, listen, gentlemen, it has been an absolute pleasure to speak to you both again. I mean, obviously, we saw each other this week, but it's been a pleasure to work with you as well, for both of us. And we're so grateful for you stepping in at this last minute to come talk to us. But I think people will take a great deal from this. I've got to ask one more question, if I may. Are we going to get a B2C book, the business to customer book, having had this experience of doing this? I know it's your expertise in B2B, but it feels to me that there's another book in you guys.
It's a bit early for that. I think they said
they need to bask in their glory first.
I know. After Steve Redgrave won his fourth Olympic gold, he said, if you see me anywhere near a boat, you can shoot me. And I feel a bit like that about writing another book right now. But that might change in a few months.
Yeah, never say never.
You'd go in and win another gold medal after that. So I think it's more likely, and Steve's already got ideas, which is worrying, but it's perhaps more likely we might write one around sales leadership.
Right.
Okay. That's our other area of expertise. We're not experts in the B2C market, so I don't think that would be appropriate. But we do work with a lot of sales managers and leaders, and there's a huge kind of absence of coaching in businesses that is so needed to complement sales training, that's something I think there's a real gap in the market for.
Fair play.
There you go. So it sounds like you've got a little bit of a gem of a plan.
Well, we're waiting for that project. Right. Yes, thank you so much. And all the best with Transformational Selling, which is out now.
Great.
Thank you.
Always great fun to spend some time with Bryn and Steve, I have to say. And this is a sort of flash review from one of their contemporaries, who's also a big sales trainer, a guy called Jem Duduku. Now, he's also an author. He's written a couple of novels, and he's written a whole load of history books as well. That's his sideline. and he describes this book, Transformational Selling, as the best sales book he's ever read. And he was only a third of the way through. I don't know if it tails off the second.
Well, the story goes that he bought a copy at the launch in London, the one you went to. He went home, and he went to bed, and he started reading. And he couldn't put it down, which is what we love to hear as publishers.
Absolutely.
But that to be of a business book is even better, you know.
It's No, well, especially if you're in that field. But I think it is. I have said this, and I was saying this to I was blue in the face at the launch in London on Wednesday, that genuinely this is a crossover book where anybody could pick it up and get something from it without having to be in the sales side of things. I think it's one of those rare business books that doesn't disappear into its own sort of mythology.
Exactly. And it doesn't just say, we did this and we are now millionaires. Or it's not preachy in any way.
No, it's not.
It's so relatable. And I got a lot out of it when I was editing it, even though, like you say, we're mostly B2C, as it's called, business to customer. But we are also business to business, because we also have to persuade retail to stock our book. So that is a business-to-business transaction, isn't it? So it is relevant. And I did learn an awful lot from their book. So I think it is wider than its original remit. And the anecdotes are brilliant. It's worth reading just for that. Bryn naked in Finland.
We'll leave it there. Thank you so much to them for joining us on the show this week. And our guest next week is...
Our guest next week is, in fact, we accidentally announced him a couple of weeks ago, which was totally my fault, but he is really coming on this following week, and that is Nick Edmonds, who is a GP turned crime writer.
Wow. You'd think that GPs didn't have time to do anything else, you know, judging by the sort of...
It's quite a funny story, isn't it? So we sat down to do the podcast. You'd sent him the link, and he didn't turn up. So I sent him an email.
I've got a feeling he's a retired GP. So in fairness, he has got time to write.
Yes, he has got time.
But yeah.
So we sent him a link, and we sat here with the headphones on, the microphones all ready. He didn't appear. So I sent him a quick message, and he replied with a photo of Berlin and said, I'm in Berlin.
And he was.
I'm not supposed to be doing the podcast today.
No, fair enough. Our mistake, and we apologise for that.
My mistake.
We work as a collective.
Okay.
You know, I may have cursed you when we were sat here for 45 minutes waiting for somebody who was in Berlin on the wrong week, but that's by the by. We move on. We move on into the week to come. And, well, at the end of the week, we've got Easter holidays with kids back in our...
Oh, I better get buying eggs, hadn't I?
Yeah. So that's fast approaching. And, well, look, I'm almost through, literally, you know, within sort of whenever you get this podcast, I should be just about finishing the fourth of five Roman legionary epics that I've been recording for WF Howes Limited, which is when I got the offer, it was fantastic. You know, not going to knock it, but it was pretty daunting, wasn't it? But I think it's proven two things. First of all, I found my stamina for doing the audiobooks, but the benefit of having the studio and having invested in some new software and hardware that makes everything essentially go into the computer to a quality level that doesn't mean I have to edit too much has made a huge difference.
Absolutely. So,
but boy, I mean, you could probably hear it in my voice. I'm a bit rough now. I did four long chapters today, and I've got another one to go. And there isn't much left at the end of each day, is there?
No, by the evening, while you're doing these books, you're a bit of a zombie sat in the chair.
I am.
Fair enough, you know, and I try not to talk to you too much because I don't want to hurt your voice. But, it's been quite good. And from a personal perspective, it's meant that I've got lots of work done because it's been quiet.
Oh, thanks.
You know, I'm joking.
Yeah, right. I'm sure you are. Okay, on that bombshell, we'll leave you for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget to go to our website, www.hobeck.net, for details of our Hobeck books and our wonderful crime fiction authors. Brilliant, and we look forward to seeing you there. But also, we'd like to thank you for listening to us on the podcast, and please subscribe to wherever you get your podcasts from. It means a great deal to us. So for myself, Adrian Hobart.
And myself, Rebecca Collins.
We wish you a wonderful and
creative
week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.